This is part two, or an IOB extra, with Dr. Chris Draper, the author of Velocity Economics. You heard that I was going to ask him about this sounding much like socialism, and you'll hear his answer. Then Dr. Draper will talk about some headwinds that are keeping people from creating businesses and wealth, and what his theory does about that. Dr. Chris Draper and Velocity Economics, next. Insight on Business, the News Hour, is made possible through the support of AARP. You know, it doesn't matter what your age is, there are real possibilities for every member of the family with AARP. From fraud prevention sessions to voter awareness to free tax help and so much more. Learn all you can and Google AARP Iowa for real possibilities.
Insight on Business, the News Hour, is brought to you by Tarot International. Achieve, lead, and outclass with Tarot. TERO.com. And the Iowa Business Journals. News and information for small to mid-sized businesses. IowaBusinessJournals.com.
Welcome back to the Business News Hour. This is Insight on Business Extra with Dr. Chris Draper. He is the author of Velocity Economics, a new way of thinking. Actually, it's really not a new way of thinking. It's just a way of thinking that we have not employed when it comes to economics in the United States for a very, very long time. When we left, Chris, the former conversation that we were having, my next question is, well, this sounds a heck of a lot like those commie red pinko tools of Hanoi or something. This is socialism. You're trying to socialize an industrial nation like the United States. That's wrong, isn't it?
Well, I mean, Milton Friedman and Adam Smith didn't think so. But I think when we go back to the origin of the concept, the origin of what we're looking at here, I think there's two problems with that. Number one, we've allowed for the conversation of looking out for removing impediments for average Americans. The idea that if I remove impediments for average Americans, I remove their impediment for creating wealth. If I remove their access to providing for their kids, if I remove their access for achieving their highest potential, well, that must be socialism. Now, that seems odd. You know, I mean, to me, if I'm looking at capitalism at its fundamental core is accelerating your ability to do business to the point where in an efficient environment, this is an important piece, in an efficient environment, everyone finds the value of their labor through their hard work, but other people are working hard enough that now it all balances out. And everyone's rewarded based on what they're worth because we don't have, again, the invisible hand of either government holding you down, theoretically, or unions holding you down, theoretically, or, more specifically, inequitable tax policies, inequitable subsidies, inequity that actually goes to the top more often than it does the bottom. That's actually our modern capitalism right now, and that's actually far more socialist and far more, I guess, communist than what we're actually really talking about, true communism. True communism, you know, true capitalism is let's let everyone go in a fair space with a fair referee and figure out how they can actually earn what they want. And ironically, once we actually do that effectively, we end up with, hopefully, if it's efficient, everyone getting what they earn, everyone what they're working for, and we're not saying anything different from that. We're saying we should be removing every impediment that prevents an individual from achieving their potential and earning what they've actually created and earning the wealth as quickly as they can that they actually deserve. That's very different than what we're trying to brand socialism as.
Chris Draper, ladies and gentlemen. All right, let me follow that line of thinking, if I might, for just a moment. You talk about impediments to productivity, impediments to growth, impediments of individuals creating wealth for themselves, which then, of course, gets spent at mom and pop grocery stores and the restaurant or wherever it happens to be. Some of those impediments, you started to click them off. One, childcare. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, businesses are clamoring. Iowa is the lowest unemployed state in the nation right now.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We lead all other states with a low unemployment. Mm-hmm. So businesses out there are scrambling trying to find people. All right? So one of those things that people are concerned about is childcare. Another thing that people are concerned about is healthcare. I mean, you know, healthcare portability is gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't, if you work for a company, you're fortunate enough to have healthcare insurance. If you leave that company, good luck.
Right.
So that's another impediment. I would also suggest to you that education might be another impediment. And how is that? Because students are taking out student loans to go on to school, and then they're saddled with debt $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $100,000 that they're never going to get rid of, and they're going to pay high interest rates on it. So another impediment to productivity and wealth creation. I've just named three.
Oh, and you've named a few of my biggest big ones, too, because the child care, number one. Do you know who actually was going to provide universal child care? Nixon. Nixon proposed universal child care. The amount of wealth generation that Nixon, of all people, right? I mean, I think we just saw one of his associates saw how well his life turned out yesterday, right? Nixon, and it was Buchanan who killed it, right, on the idea that universal child care is communist, right? Over and over and over, we're allowing solutions that remove impediments to wealth generation, wealth creation, and individual responsibility to be killed by this argument that it's somehow, you know, not good to have something that benefits us. I don't mean to be flip on the argument against it, because you say it out loud, it makes no sense. If it costs me $50 per day to put one kid into daycare, I'm going to be working for 6 hours at the average job before I can actually make 2 hours a day. And now school only lasts for 6 hours on a day unless I want to pay another $50 for the kid to stay there longer. So we end up with this environment where individuals are working full-time jobs at good pay just to make less than minimum wage. And that is just crazy. That's an impediment to our access to grow. Similarly, healthcare. Your average American, when you take the full cost, this was the biggest, and in my opinion, if you're going to be cynical and mean, the biggest strategic win of the side that was anti-ACA, the anti-Obamacare, as they're calling it, is they were comparing my premiums that I pay as an employee of a company to what I pay with ACA. The real comparison is ACA to COBRA. The real comparison is the fully loaded cost. If I look at the fully loaded cost of private insurance in America, it averages 26% of the average salary.
Not much left for housing.
Well, housing, Iowa, we're lucky, but in most of the country, housing is a big, big problem. And Iowa, actually, for majority of Iowans, housing here is a big challenge. Rental housing in Des Moines area specifically is a big challenge. Small communities is worse. I mean, you're not going to get individuals to come work at a place like Vermeer if they're not really highly paid, if they're going to have to pay for housing in a rural area where the housing and the rental opportunities in that area are just impossible. But healthcare alone, if I just added an opt-in to Medicaid, that doesn't mean you can't have your own insurance, right? The NHS in Britain says, here's a level of insurance you can have and you don't get any extras. You got to wait in line. If you got something that's non-vital, you got to wait your turn. The guy who's dying, he gets to go first, right? That's fine, because that's sort of how that should be in an environment where we don't want people dying on the streets. But to actually opt into Medicaid, if you just gave me optional opt-in for Medicaid, that's only going to cost me about 10 to 12% of my salary for the same outcomes. So I'm fundamentally saving 14 to 16% of money that could be going into parks, into garbage collection, into schools, education. Your average college graduate is currently coming out with a negative 23% disposable income because I have non-dischargeable student debt. I have these guaranteed costs, which mean I have no way to get ahead. I was at we'll leave them nameless just for the sake of it, but I was at a large college had their president was speaking at an event in Des Moines the other month. And they were talking about how they really, really want to invest in entrepreneurism. They want to do entrepreneurism this and this and that. So they're going to put this and they're going to have this program. They can calculate this and they can connect them with this and this and the other, right? But the one topic that was not on the table that is the number one impediment to entrepreneurism is student loan debt. We are going into an environment where not only is our first problem of student loan debt at the student level, when I graduate and I'm guaranteed in May I graduate, I get my cap, I pay an extra fee for graduation, I pay a fee for rental of all my gown, and I get some pictures, which then they charge me a fee on. In 6 months, I have to pay between $250 to $450 per month, dollars, $250 a month, right? In Iowa, that's rent. Right, and that's not to disparage Iowa, $450 is a lot of money anywhere. If you're 21 years old, if your average job you're going to be getting is on the order of $15 per hour, $450 a month is real money, right? And if I know I've got $450 and I'm somewhere like I am in Iowa where I actually do pay my bills, right? This isn't like some New York real estate thing, right? But like if you actually are going to pay your bills and you actually owe up to your responsibilities, you're not taking a risk if you owe $450 per month. And if I'm not going to take a risk, how do I start a new business? How do I go off and raise money to be able to actually go and start something completely new? How do I go off into this environment and say, I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. But my $450 is mandatory and they will actually come after me. And that doesn't actually go away in bankruptcy. If you are talking entrepreneurism as a college president and you're not talking student debt, you're lying. Mm-hmm. But more importantly now, what's more systemically brutal within the actual small college space, for example, is we're finally reaching, they're talking about, okay, yeah, we've had a contraction in birth rates, and then there's a certain thing with the market where we're going down in enrollment, and it's only going to be a blip, and it's going to go back up because it's not a big deal, right? The one thing they're not telling you is starting a few years ago and accelerating now, we're starting to get kids who can't afford to go to college and they need loans. And now they can't go because their parents now have so much debt that they can't co-sign. We have now two generations of debt that are impeding our ability to, number one, innovate once they're out, and more importantly, get access to the networks they need to innovate. And if we're not going to be realistic about those, education is one of our biggest long-term impediments that we attempt to address in Velocity Economics. Because there's a lot of solutions. This wasn't supposed to be the book show, but I wrote a book the other year called Rediscovering Our Future, The Modern Liberal Arts Manifesto. One of the things we revisit in Velocity Economics is right now, the majority of the debt of the individuals that go through college is owned by the government.
The government, yeah.
What if the majority of that debt was actually owned by alumni? What if we required the alumni to own over 51% of the debt of a college? Now, the alumni are probably going to be pretty interested in making sure that the product of the college is good. They're probably going to be pretty interested in actually going to the president and saying, what are you doing to make sure that my debt gets repaid? More importantly, what if we actually made a royalty-based system that's actually a revenue-based system in repayments is actually a revenue-based system? If I was an alumni and the president's bringing in a bunch of kids that aren't prepared for college and they're not putting in programs that actually help them achieve their potential, and I was now an investor in this college because the college has to have alumni owning over half the debt, and the kids are paying back as a function of their future earnings, which is what you do in Britain. In Britain, and I'm not saying Britain's the best place on earth, we can see that they fell faster than us, right? I think Ricky Gervais said it best, is like, you know, I'm from that little island that used to rule the world before you guys, right? But in Britain, if you make under a certain threshold amount, you don't pay back on your student debts. And once you make over that amount, you only pay 7% of your earnings above that level. That's manageable. That's something that will not impede innovation. It's something that we can actually guarantee that our students can actually pay going forward. It's something they can invest in. And if I own that debt of that university and I'm looking at these students and saying, man, I only get my money back or my money is at risk if this kid doesn't perform, I'm probably going to give him some options. And I'm probably going to make sure his education is better. I'm probably going to actually have an alumni network that elongates my contact, that expands the generations that engage, and more broadly outside of education, hopefully that's what we want for America. We want to say, here's the next generation coming up. I want to make sure they're not cash burdened in a manner that kills productivity and opportunity. And I want to make sure there's a long-term commitment that after I invest in them, they invest in me, and we actually ensure that we all safely arrive at our highest potential in the business environment. If we're looking at small businesses right now in Iowa, 100% of them are going to transition ownership in the next 10 years. But one of our big impediments to transitioning businesses is that gap funding in the middle. So if I'm going to buy a business that's existing, it's got employees, it's got revenue, it's got all kinds of assets it's acquired over the course of 20 years, but it's also become unbankable. No bank is going to give it a new loan. It needs to innovate. It needs a new generation. They haven't done an ESOP, so they're actually in trouble. 85% of them actually don't even have a plan for what they're going to do. They just hope they don't die in the office, right? And how do we actually, if I'm a smaller business, we have one down the hall here. Kyle Steele of SEO Expert just bought a social media company a year or two ago, right? Now, I won't tell you the price pieces, but the fact is for the average American of his age, he was lucky he was able to actually have that piece, right? We have a lot of these businesses that could actually skip a generation down and really fundamentally innovate and change what is a traditional business, which right now is a startup because it can't get funding, it has some stuff, it can't prove a new model. And all we need is a middle gap loan that isn't so cost impactful that it kills that business. Well, our current lending model and the current payback models and the current interest model right now, that's an impediment for an area that we need a solution for. And there's going to be a lot of small business owners, like those that we work with on a day-to-day basis, who don't know how they're getting out. And they're scared. And they believe trickle-down is going to help them because, you know, if I was really had no plan, I'd hope there was a dinosaur in the clouds too. Right?
So what you're saying is that we come back to fear, and fear drives the outcome.
Fear drives the outcome as long as we don't have a clear, linear, intellectually accurate argument that's going to get us to where we need to go. And that, in my argument, is Velocity Economics.
Velocity Economics, ladies and gentlemen. The book is out. We will have links up on the radio blog so you can find out more and order your copy. Chris Draper, thanks so very much for spending some extra time with us talking about your theory of economics. Thanks.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Once again, that was Dr. Chris Draper, the author of Velocity Economics. We'll have links, of course, for all of that up on our radio blog. Interesting conversation. All right, that does it for today. Thanks so very much for listening. Insight on Business, the News Hour, is produced by our friend Chap Ramsey. Sales and marketing falls to Aaron Libby. The voice of the Business News Hour is Hunter Pease. And the music you're hearing right now is created exclusively for the Business News Hour by James Goodlett from Jam Good Productions. You need some original music for your project? Yeah, we can hook you up. For all those folks, my name's Michael Libby. Have yourself a wonderful evening. Be safe, be well, be careful most of all. Be good to your fellow man. Good day.